1-0. Houston, you have a problem. Lakers, get it done in game one.
They have many problems
in Houston. We got a lot to talk about on today's show. Welcome in, everybody. This is the Lakers Collective. I'm Trevor Lane, Jovan Buha, Jason Timpf. Guys, feels good to be coming in after a game one win.
Yeah, it's good to see you guys. I think the best we could have hoped for in a series, regardless of what happens from this point forward, is for the Lakers to believe they can win and to give us just the best effort that they possibly can in under the circumstances. And they made that very clear in game one that that's what they're going to try to do in this series.
Playoff LeBron masterclass.
Let's go. What a game. All right, let's just dive into it. The game one reaction. So the Lakers win it. Even once the KD injury was announced, the Lakers were still the underdogs going into this game, according to the betting lines. Most I saw had them as the Rockets were a -2.5 favorite, which is pretty close, but still, the Lakers were the underdogs for this game. It wasn't perfect. The Lakers spent all week talking about rebounding, talking about hanging on to the basketball, taking care of the ball, and they did neither of those things. They lost the turnover battle, and they got demolished on the glass, 21-3 in offensive rebounds. It helps when you miss a lot of shots, though, to get a lot of offensive rebounds, but still, the offensive rebound percentage for the Rockets off the charts, and yet the Lakers got the win with efficiency. I thought their shooting was phenomenal. Obviously, we'll talk about Luke Kennard, but the Lakers found their way through despite coming up way short in both of the key areas that they were focused on going into the game. So I guess let's start there. Jason, for a team that was so focused on rebounding and taking care of the basketball, was game one a success simply because they won? Was it an incomplete because they need to get better? Like, how do you rate that game from what the Lakers' objectives were?
Yeah, I actually thought they did better in those two areas than it appeared on the surface. On the one hand, on the offensive glass, 7 of Houston's 21 offensive rebounds came in like the final 5-minute stretch after the Lakers went up 16, where it's just a classic case of like Lakers have kind of disengaged a little bit because they think the game's over and Houston's playing with that desperate effort. So really, while the game was hanging in the balance, they gave up 14 offensive rebounds. And there's definitely some stuff to clean up in there. I thought in the first half, the rebounding was better. They only allowed 7 in the first half. There were only a handful of real mistakes. I thought in the second half, they started to slip in their execution a little bit. There was a lot of standing around. The guy that really stood out to me on film that needs to do more on the glass is Rui. He only had two defensive rebounds in the entire game, but a big part of it was he was doing a lot of standing around when there were some contested rebound situations. I think that can get cleaned up a little bit. The turnovers, I also kind of came around to this can be cleaned up in the sense that, do you guys remember on Thursday when we got that question talking about like, oh, should the Lakers look to push the ball in transition more? And mm-hmm. One of the things I said was like, yeah, selectively when they have like a clear advantage, but they don't want to get into an open floor game with a more athletic team. And I thought there were several examples in that game, about a half dozen, where they turned the basketball over, kind of forcing transition opportunities that weren't there, which is a textbook
example. That late second quarter was just brutal.
That was rough.
Yeah, exactly. And there were a few other examples at other stretches of the game as well, beyond just the late second quarter run, where like those are easy to clean up. And by the way, JJ was right on that in the post game presser. He's like, I thought we kind of forced it a little bit in transition. So the only other big turnover thing that I think they can clean up is some of the high post entry stuff to LeBron, where the guards just got a little rushed and they need to actually wait for LeBron to secure position before they throw the entry pass. But they're definitely capable of cleaning up those margins in just those simple ways. But they're going to have to, because the Lakers shot extremely well. They were 7-for-15 on catch and shoot threes. They were 11-for-17 on off the dribble jump shots, 8-for-13 from mid range, 3-for-4 on pull up threes. So like in total, if you put it all together, is 1.47 points per jump shot, which is kind of insane. So what that says to me is like, that's probably the best shooting game the Lakers will have in the series. So it's mm-hmm. actually very, very important that they clean up some of those specific details with the defensive glass and with the turnovers. But as I said, I think some of those are easy, just simple execution things. Don't force it in transition when it's not there. Wait for your high post entry to be actually in position before you make a pass fake and get the ball in. And then again, I just think a little bit better defensive rebounding effort from some key guys like Rui And I think the Stars too, Marcus, Luke, and LeBron each had some stand-around possessions in the second half where they just started to get tired. So they're going to have to definitely clean some of that stuff up as we move forward in the series.
Oh, LeBron got pissed at Rui. That one possession where he tried to make the entry pass and just completely botched it. He was not happy with that. I do think they can clean up those areas that we're talking about, which I think will help mitigate, because you're right. This is an outlier shooting game for sure for the Lakers. But I do think they can clean up the turnovers, can get a bit better. I don't expect them to win the offensive rebound battle, but I think they can get a bit better there. That gives me optimism that this is not... In terms of winning the game, that in and of itself is not unsustainable. The shooting is unsustainable, but there's also things that they can do to mitigate a natural drop in the shooting percentages. Jovan, what were your takeaways from this game?
My biggest takeaway was it feels like the Lakers are playing chess and the Rockets are playing checkers. This was a game that the Lakers, I thought, had to win. Game one, for a variety of reasons. I mean, we talked about the importance of going into a series as a home underdog is rare, and just the need for the group to, I think, land that first punch. But then you add in the pressure of KD being out, and we don't have clarity yet. I'm sure we'll know in a couple hours post Rockets practice, like, what's his status or where's he at? Can he potentially play in game two? Like, once KD was out, it was like, okay, the Lakers, like, there's a little bit more pressure now to actually win, because if this is the one game of the series that he misses, you would like to at least win that game. But I thought the Lakers, like, the intentionality that they came out with to open that game, like, that first 5 minutes of that game was maybe my, like, favorite stretch of Lakers offense. And it wasn't just because, I mean, yes, I think they started, like, 8 for 10 in every starter scored over that stretch, but it was just the actions that they were running, and it was relatively simple. It was a lot of DHOs and side to side, and but it was like, you know, a pick and roll flowing into a DHO with like an empty corner, or you know, a post up into a flare screen, or just the beauty and the simplicity of the offense, and just everybody screening, rolling, passing, and being involved. It was clear, and like JJ had talked about this during the week, he talked about it after the game, that with things shifting so dramatically with no Luka and Austin, they were going to have to be more intentional with how they attacked Houston, and it was going to have to be the little things offensively in terms of the timing of cuts, screens and screening angles and decision making and processing. And like, it just felt like the Lakers were continually a step or two ahead of Houston for the entire game. And there was a couple parts there where it got close, right? I mean, to start, it was relatively close to close the second quarter, and then again for parts of the third quarter. But it never really felt like the game was in doubt. The Lakers led for 93% of this game. And again, no matter how close it got, it felt like the Lakers were in control. And like, it just, to me, was there are certainly things I could clean up. The turnovers, the offensive rebounding, I think they could be even better with their shot selection and shot quality. But for them to control the game so decisively and to have a couple of key areas that were supposed to be X factors go against them and they still win the game, like, that to me was as encouraging as anything. Because like, on the one side, we can look at the shot quality, which if you want to look at some of the nerdy numbers, Houston had an expected effective field goal percentage of 53%. They shot 43%, so they underperformed by 10%. Lakers had an expected effective field goal percentage of 50%. They shot 68%, so they were nearly 20% higher. That's a huge swing on both sides. This might be the best game the Lakers shoot all series. It might be the worst game the Rockets shoot all series. Despite all that, though, Rockets had 27 more field goal attempts. They had the same number of free throws. So they dominated the possession game, and LA still won convincingly. So I would also argue, like, this might be the most offensive rebounds the Rockets have. This might be the biggest the turnover gap is all series. So even if the Lakers shoot worse, the Rockets shoot better, they're also going to get fewer offensive rebounds, and LA's not going to turn the ball over as much. So I think there are things we can look at that aren't going to sustain for the entirety of the series, but I thought LA controlled the entire game. It was on their terms. And I think Houston's going to have to make a lot of changes and a lot of adjustments to get this back to more even playing ground.
Yeah, I think this was a, I thought the Lakers, frankly, were the better team. They looked like the more prepared team. They outplayed the Rockets. There was a more determination from the Lakers. I thought they were the aggressor from the opening tip. Not that they were the more athletic team, but they were the more intentional team with everything they were doing out there on the court. I really loved, this is so difficult to do, really, but how much the Lakers offense has shifted in the wake of Luka and Austin being out. They went from being a super high volume, high pick and roll team to now a lot of stuff is getting LeBron the ball on the move, coming off a little curls and things of that nature, rather than, okay, LeBron, here's the ball. We're going to go run high pick and roll with you now. And let's see how that goes. They've adapted very, very well to what's going on now with Luka, with Austin being out. And so I give JJ Redick and the coaching staff a lot of credit for that. I thought JJ just flat out, you know, Ime Udoka has not done a great job, but I thought JJ very clearly outcoached Ime Udoka. Jason, what do you think we saw from this game that was sustainable for the Lakers, even if the shooting was not?
Yeah, the execution piece, I think, is something that will be there throughout the series. I mean, we already talked about the stuff they have to clean up with turnovers and and rebounding, but the way they look to attack, again, like, and I thought Jovan laid it out really well, like, if you ask LeBron to play Luka Doncic ball and dribble the ball 30 times per possession out above the break into ball screens just over and over again, it makes him susceptible to wear and tear from ball pressure, and he very likely fatigues a lot faster. It puts the emphasis on his ability to make plays with his legs, as opposed to putting him in a situation where I was on with Kevin O'Connor this morning, and he shared these numbers, and I can't remember exactly what they were off the top of my head, but I think he said it was about 3 seconds per touch with LeBron in that game and about 2 dribbles per touch for LeBron in that game, or the opposite, 3 dribbles, 2 seconds, but it was like under 3 for both dribbles per touch and seconds per touch on the actions that he was running in this game. And what that does is it essentially takes the emphasis off of LeBron's ability to handle ball pressure and deal with dribbling the basketball 30 feet from the basket and fatiguing. And it puts the emphasis on his ability to fight for position, which is an emphasis on his size and strength rather than his like high volume ball handling. And it puts the emphasis on his brain. It puts an accent on his ability to make simple decisions, whether it's he's the passing fulcrum and there's off ball action being run and he's the trigger man, whether it's, you know, simple stuff like, okay, I know that if I Marcus Smart has the ball on the right block, I know that if I like pretend like I'm going to come off a DHO and back cut, I'm almost certainly going to draw help. And then it's a quick hit to Rui Hachimura in the corner. Just like really simple decisions that LeBron has made thousands of times in his career that, again, he's one of the very smartest players in the history of the league when it comes to doing those sorts of things. So I thought in general, that emphasis on running organized action just kind of allowed the Lakers to have an emphasis on execution rather than supreme individual greatness, which is something you're going to rely on more if Luka Doncic is in the fold. And I'd extend that to both Marcus and Luke as well. Just like that deliberate targeting of Şengün and Reed Shepard, the keeping them in organized action as much as possible. It just allowed those guys to similarly not have to break down Amen Thompson off the dribble or do these. The only guy who was really like doing some like intense dribble penetration from the perimeter was like Marcus Smart against guys like Reed. Like he would just, every time he saw Reed, he would just take 2 or 3 really aggressive dribbles and like turn his back and like kind of turn it into a post up or a drive to try to get some sort of initial penetration. But for the most part, they didn't need to get dribble penetration against Houston to score. That's going to stay. So like, to Jovan's point, as the margins come back under control, their shooting will come back down to earth, but it should still be a dynamic where they have an execution advantage over the larger sample. I think where it becomes more complicated is when Kevin Durant, if he rejoins the equation, if he comes back into the equation, it just changes the math for them really on both ends of the floor. And I mean, did you guys see the videos of him doing his warm-up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
He looked visibly frustrated. He did not look comfortable. And the way they broke down the injury was that like it was right above his patella tendon. So that makes me feel like it's like kind of in the bone of his kneecap a little bit. Now we'll see what this ends up being. But like any of you guys who have played basketball have taken a real knee to knee contact where like it like hits the center of your kneecap. there's like a really sharp pain in that area that tends to linger for a while as the bone is kind of like bruised a little bit. So like it could be a pain tolerance thing for him that's difficult for him to manage even if he comes back. So it's definitely a very interesting series now that Kevin Durant's status is up in the air.
Yeah, that'll be something certainly to watch when the injury report comes out later. I would imagine even if he's a full go, Houston will probably list him as questionable at best, just to kind of keep that mystery out there, that gamesmanship. But still, we'll get an injury update on him. And if he's not a go for game two, if this becomes more of a long-term problem, I think this very well flips the series in the Lakers' favor compared to what we would have thought coming in. Now, I do want to address one thing. I'm seeing a little bit of the conversation in the chat right now that, well, you know, the ball is simply moving more for the Lakers now. See, this is the way that the Lakers need to play. And Luka was not allowing the ball to move the way he needed to. Keep in mind that you may find, and indeed, if you dig into the numbers, the Lakers passed the ball more since they lost Luka compared to before. Some of that is you have less guys who are capable of breaking down their man one-on-one, and so they're naturally going to move the ball more. But I think there's two things that sometimes get confused, and that's the aesthetics of something, and that's seeing the ball move. There is a certain joy to that. I like seeing everybody get involved. I've talked about it on our shows before. I've talked about it during the live play-by-plays that I do. But there's a difference between that and efficient offense. And what Luka does, while some people may not find it as aesthetically pleasing, others may, there is no denying that it is very effective and very efficient offensively. And that ultimately is the goal, putting the ball in the basket. The Lakers are a better offensive team with Luka Doncic than without. So it's not like watching this game and saying, oh, I like seeing the ball move the way it does. You can't make that leap that, oh, see, they're better without Luka because the ball is moving more. And we know there's agendas and things out there, but sometimes people get confused by what they see versus what the numbers will actually tell you. And the ultimate goal, whether you enjoy the way that it happens or not, the ultimate goal is to put the ball in the basket as efficiently as possible. And with that being the case, there's no denying that they absolutely miss Luka, and hopefully, fingers crossed, they can get back Luka and or Austin at some point. Well, yeah, if it's not in this series, then hopefully by the next one. I don't know. Jovan, do you want to? I know you've addressed that question as well quite a bit. Do you have anything you want to add to that topic?
Not really. I mean, I don't think every game has to be a referendum on yes. Luka or LeBron or Austin. I've talked about this all season. Like, I feel like there's always this, whatever the result is, positive or negative, it has to mean somebody is better than somebody, or somebody's great, somebody sucks. It's just, we can appreciate LeBron's greatness, and I mean, this is the reason why I think he's the GOAT. And for him to control a playoff game from start to finish at 41, just, I mean, I don't know if anyone else in history could do what he just did in that game one at that age with that mileage, etc. But that does not mean that Luka also isn't great and is one of the best players in the world and one of the best offensive players in the world. And also, playoff Luka is a thing. And if you look at his playoff performances, Luka's a monster in the postseason. And I think we saw some of that against Minnesota, but I think we would have seen it at a different level had he been available. So I don't really want to keep having to, you know, reanalyze or relitigate Luka's season, LeBron's season. Like, got to move forward and evaluate things with where they're at. And it was a great game one. Offense looked great, and LeBron played amazing.
Yeah, he absolutely was fantastic. And here's what I love about the way LeBron played the game is you can see it on the floor. His supercomputer of a brain, just reading each situation and saying, this is what the game needs from me in this moment. Hey, we really need a bucket. All right, I'm going to take a tough fadeaway and I'm going to knock it down, right? I can go ahead and get us a bucket when we need it. I need to get other guys going. Cool. I'm going to break my own record for assists in a quarter of a playoff game. I'm going to put up 8 assists in the first quarter. I'm going to keep the ball moving. I see DA flashing into the paint there. I'm going to get him the shot. I'm going to kick the ball out to Rui. He's going to drain a three. He's got the ability to just manipulate the game all the way throughout. And that's what's got me confident here going into game two. I don't know exactly what LeBron's performance will be. Will it be a high assist game? Will it be a high scoring game? Will it be a bit of both? Will he be making a bunch of plays on the defensive end? Which way is LeBron going to approach it? But what I am confident in, it's that whatever the game needs, that's what LeBron will provide.
Exactly. It's like a puzzle. Each game is like a puzzle. I think LeBron is, yeah, I've talked about this before, but I think LeBron is the best possible leader to have for a team that like is serious about winning in the playoffs. He can, you know, we all know LeBron can get a little bit passive aggressive and have some issues when a team is deeply flawed. Like that's, you know, as it's been well documented, he's probably not the best leader for a Russell Westbrook led team here, a Russell Westbrook team, you know, because it's going to involve a lot of passive aggressive stuff. But, you know, LeBron just knows that it's a marathon, not a sprint. He knows that there's runs. He knows there's going to be swings. He knows they'll lose games in this series. They know he's the perfect guy to lead them through the up and downs of this process.
Let me ask you this, Jason. LeBron is known for game one being kind of his feel out game. Was there any element of that to this, or do you think this was just a full force LeBron, we're not feeling this out, you know, no breaks?
I think as soon as it was announced that Kevin Durant was out, it was like, we have to get this one, you know? And like, I think in general, like we talked about, the early part of the series is where the Lakers have the biggest advantage strategically. And over time, just through reps, Houston is going to figure some stuff out even without a strategic advantage. And so I think LeBron knew that in this particular series, he didn't really have the luxury of easing into it. Because, you know, when you get into the later series, all of a sudden it becomes like, well, we know everything about each other. We know exactly what both teams are going to do. It's, can you score on us? Can we score on you? And that's where you're, talent can be an advantage. And there have been a lot of Cavs teams and even Lakers teams early on where it's like, you know, we're feeling it out because over the course of the series, we like our chances to solve this puzzle. This is a team that is operating at a disadvantage. And as the series progresses, it's actually an advantage towards Houston, unless Luka comes back, which again is a completely different story. So really, I think LeBron understands that his best chance to get the upset is to go up 2-1 or to go up 3-1 and to try to put this thing away early.
Agreed. I think we're going to continue to see a very locked in version of LeBron James here. All right, we need to talk about what changes are going to be made now. What are the adjustments going to look like for game two? We'll get to that in just a moment. First, a quick shout out to our sponsor, and that is Prize Picks. You guys have heard us talk about Prize Picks before. You can use the code HMA, play $5, get $50 instantly. Link is in the description down below. I'm excited I did it right again. That means I'm remembering how to actually run this machine. Looking at some of these, I look at Anthony Edwards, 26.5 points, Minnesota back kind of against the wall. Jason, where do you think he clears that?
Man, that's an interesting one because they're bringing Jokic up to the level and it's so much more of a passing series for Anthony Edwards. But at the same time, he does tend to try to solve his basketball problems by shooting and he had a low scoring game. So I think I'm a little more on the fence on that one. I think maybe what do you guys think about under on the Jokic assists, considering I think they might take Gobert off of Jokic and force Jokic to be more of a scorer?
It's not a bad idea.
I mean, I feel like he kind of walks into 10 assists, but
that's a good point.
It is a good line. I was looking at McDaniel's 4.5 2-point field goal makes. I could see him getting to 5.
I like that one.
Okay, let's go with that.
That feels a little low for him.
He sneaks along the baseline enough, gets some of those little dumper spot finishes and things of that nature. Okay, let's take a look at, and these are some of the popular ones that we're looking at right here.
Cat's got a really good matchup versus Onyeka Okongwu. He's a real problem for him. I like the Cat one.
21 points. We want to go more on Cat, 21 points?
Yeah, I think I like that
one. Okay. All right, let's go with that. All right, if you guys are in on it, go check out Prize Picks. Use the link in the description down below. That code is HMA. Play $5, get $50. $10 entry fee on this one would win you $30. Go check them out, and we appreciate Prize Picks for being a great sponsor for our show. All right, let's talk a little bit about where things adjust from here. Whoops, there we go. All right, where things adjust from here. So the Rockets, obviously, it is incumbent upon them to make the significant changes now. We've already heard Amen Thompson say he's going to change the way he's defending, be a little more focused on Luke Kennard, who absolutely went berserk last game, was phenomenal. Jovan, what are you expecting different from the Rockets? I guess let's start with that side of things coming into game two.
It's a long list of what should be different. I mean, I think a big thing for them in rewatching the game yesterday and just taking my notes from the Lakers side, like I think they need to pressure the ball more and leverage their athleticism. And they did that a little bit late in the game when they tried to go on that run with like 2-3 minutes left. But I expected far more aggression and ball pressure and just force from Houston's defense. And it felt like, I mean, they were going under Luke Kennard's screens. I mean, you could start there, I guess. Like, don't go under a Luke Kennard screen. and you know, like some like simple things like that. But when it just felt over, like
Kennard was in the paint.
It almost felt like they approached it more like a regular season game. And I don't know how much of this had to do with some of the psychology with KD being out. And I don't know if that was a deflating thing for them. Like, we could go back a few games and JJ and several guys talked about the deflating nature of losing Luka and Austin. Now, that was different because it was supposed to be for, you know, potentially the entire first round, whereas KD, it's game to game. But getting him a late scratch a couple hours, I'm sure there was some impact on the group. But I think being more intentional with their offense, like it felt like their offense was aimless at times. I also think they could do a better job of trying to target some of LA's weaker defenders and entry points. Like they had one play at the very beginning of the game where they drew the switch with Luke Kennard onto Amen Thompson. They get the ISO and he just glides by Luke Kennard for a finish on the left side. Then they stopped that. They did not really go back to targeting Luke Kennard at all. And if you look at how LA attacked offensively, it was everything was, where's Reed Sheppard? We're involving him either as the primary guy or as the guy who the guy he's guarding is going to screen. Where's Şengün? We're going to attack him in the pick and roll. Where's Clint Capella? We're going to attack him in the pick and roll. And I think that's going to be another adjustment where in the season series, they started going away from Clint Capella because they realized he just can't really hang with LA's shot creators. So I think if whenever KD comes back, whether it's game 2, game 3, I think you're going to see Şengün and small ball. They're going to go with the lineups of KD and Jabari at the 4 and the 5 and just switch everything. And then it's going to be Şengün at the 5 and they're going to phase out Clint Capella, which is partly a win for the Lakers in some regards, just from like an offensive rebounding perspective. And you could also probably attack them with the rim protection even more. I just think they're going to try and switch to keep you in front of them. But I think like if you're Houston, you got to attack. I mean, Luke would be the guy that I think you have to attack. You're not going to attack Marcus. You're not attacking LeBron. You could try Rui maybe a little bit with KD. But I think Rui had an incredible defensive game. It might've been his best defensive performance, definitely of the season. I think one of his best defensive performances out of the Laker, just period. But I think Luke is the guy off the bench. You can maybe attack Jackson a little bit, try to get him in foul trouble. You're not really attacking Jake or Vando. So maybe the ninth guy, Bronny or Nick Smith, whoever ends up being the ninth guy. But I think if you're going to attack one of the top eight guys, the obvious one would be Luke just because of the size discrepancy there. And so I think, like, having a purpose offensively more so than just Alperen Şengün, here's the ball, try to do something. I think putting him in post position and drawing doubles and then playing out of that. Lakers like those baseline doubles. Can you find cutters and shooters out of that? Amen Thompson, I thought, got a pretty rough whistle at the rim. I think that's going to be something that's a little bit different in game two. Like, Lakers blocked him, stripped him several times, but they also, I thought, fouled him several times and he just didn't get the call for whatever reason. So I think that will flip where he starts to get to the free throw line more. But I don't know. I think it's, I mean, that's like the base, like the basic stuff. We could go into more stuff, but I think they need to like be targeting intentionally certain guys, certain spots on the floor. I think they did a really poor job of that.
Yeah, I agree with everything that you said there. I thought Rui specifically was really good when it came to contesting. I want to say he finished the game with 5 stocks, which is not typical of Rui. But contesting shots was a strength.
Led the team in stocks.
Right, and Rui was certainly a big part of that. He still, you know, you left something to be desired on the glass, which is par for the course with Rui. Got lost off ball a few times, but I thought he did a pretty good job at least being intentional with his defense when the ball was in front of him and then being a good guy when it came to contesting those shots. Jason, what do you expect to see different out of the Lakers in this game? I know the onus is on the Rockets to make the significant changes since they lost game one, but what do you think J.J. Redick is going to try to tweak to in advance prepare for what he expects the Rockets to switch up?
Yeah, the Rui thing is funny because it's the extra efforts that made him so good on defense. He just needs to take that for a few seconds longer into that defensive rebound pursuit because he's the combination of physically capable plus the fact that, like, even when I, like, there were possessions for LeBron, Marcus, and Luke in the second half where they were kind of standing around on the defensive glass, but those are the guys who are responsible for generating offense for the most part. So there's some, like, defensible fatigue, if you want to call it that. And I just think Rui has the best combination of resources available plus natural ability to be more impactful in the defensive glass. So that's just that next layer. And it's the same thing, same extra efforts, just extended for a few seconds. On the Lakers front, again, I think we hit on some of this stuff already. Like, I do think that JJ Redick is going to tell them to chill on the transition pushes unless they are clearly evident. I think that on the defensive glass specifically, he's going to target just some of the extra effort plays, but also some positioning stuff. Like, one of the things I noticed in this game is, like, if you're forcing a Rockets team that's got a bunch of bad shooters into some threes, you're going to have some clanks. You're going to have some long rebounds. And I thought there were several situations where the shot went up and Lakers players kind of, like, meandered into the lane and the ball went over their heads. And so I think it's going to be more of, like, a securing position around the elbows, kind of like 15 feet away from the rim kind of thing that I think will help them on the defensive glass, specifically when it comes to threes. Like, JJ talked after the game about, like, the difference between, like, how it is rebounding when Şengün's posting up. And it is different because, like, so for instance, like, Jake LaRavia gave up an offensive rebound in the first half where Şengün's posting in the middle and LaRavia, like, kind of shades over and Jayshon Tate just kind of cuts behind him from the dunker spot. And it's, like, kind of different because you don't see the crash coming because they're kind of hunting that back line in a different way than typical. And some of that stuff is genuinely hard when you're, like, asked to be operating as a helper to shrink the floor on Şengün and deal with a guy under the rim. That's so much more of, like, a disadvantage just with how Houston is built and the way they're attacking. But specifically with threes, I think working more towards the elbows and being prepared for long rebounds as they come off. And lastly, with the turnovers, just again, we mentioned this already, but just, like, wait for LeBron to establish position and make the post-entry pass after being patient. Like, ball pressure will speed you up. You can't let it speed you up. You got to take your time getting into, like, turn your back and post. You're basically posting 40 feet from the rim. Wait for LeBron to be ready. Bump him, pass fake, make the post-entry. Some of the turnovers are, like, they are what they are. Like Luke Kennard turns it over, dribbling it off his foot on the baseline, or LeBron turns it over on a spin move. Like, some of that is, like, you're asking these guys to take on high usage roles against a really good defense. Like, some of those I think are just kind of the cost of doing business when you're under the circumstances, but there are some easy ones to clean up. Offensive process stuff I really liked. I don't really have any notes. Like, we didn't really talk about it much, but I thought, even though the Lakers shot really well, I thought they took really good shots. Like, they were extremely deliberate about making the extra pass and getting the ball to the right spot. There were, like, how many bad shots did the Lakers take in this game? Like, how often were you like, I didn't like that one? It was a very strong emphasis on executing their sets and then moving the ball. Even, like, the screening, like, they got turnovers off of illegal screens, where, like, I think that Ayton set really good screens in this game. And sometimes the cost of setting really good screens is
great.
you're gonna pick up some fouls. And so overall, like, I didn't really see much of an adjustment in their offensive execution. Defense, like, I thought both Jackson and DeAndre Ayton won more battles than they lost against Şengün. I think that's good. I think they did a good job of swarming drives and making extra efforts at the rim. Even when they put in action Şengün to try to target smaller players, they just tried to refuse the switch when they could. Like, I just was really impressed in general with the Lakers' execution, and I don't think there's a ton that they need to do in terms of what they're doing in the half court. It's just, again, cleaning up the turnovers and cleaning up the offensive glass.
And I went back and looked at, I watched every offensive rebound just to kind of get a sense, all right, what is Houston doing? Some of it was that baseline crashing. Jason Tate had four offensive boards. A lot of those were situations like that. But we also saw when the Rockets were able to get a switch where there was a smaller player on Şengün, the Lakers would then respond by fronting, and that would give Şengün inside position on to get an offensive board. He got, I think it was two or three off of situations like that. There are little things that you can clean up, but there's also things that you're going to be giving up if you do. So, for example, if you're not fronting, is that just an easy pass into Sengun, and then he's going up against a smaller player? Those are some things I'd be keeping an eye on that the Rockets may try to exploit a little bit if the Lakers do reverse their strategy there. The Rockets are going to win the offensive rebound battle. That's expected. The question is, can the Lakers make it closer than 21-3? And some of it certainly is because the Rockets missed so many shots that created more offensive rebound opportunities. But they still had an incredibly high offensive rebound rate. They were in the 100th percentile. I think it was 42% off the top of my head was their offensive rebound percentage, which is still way too high. The Lakers have got to do a better job there finding a body. You're going up against guys that are pogo sticks. There were a couple of times too, I think it was even Jabari Smith got them a couple of times on second jump opportunities where the ball went up and then he not only came down but went back up before any of the other Lakers went up to go get the ball. Some of that is just going to be the natural athletic advantage of the Rockets, but I do think the Lakers have to be a bit more intentional getting a body on guys in the paint in order to help mitigate that. The turnovers as well, I agree with you, Jason. I think some of it is just you want to eliminate as many turnovers as possible, but some of it is just the situation. I mean, you've got no Luka, no Austin. You're dramatically changing things on the offensive end, asking players to be in different roles. You're naturally going to have mistakes made because of that. And while those can be frustrating, I'm not expecting the Lakers to go turn in like a 9 turnover performance or something like that. I think they should be aiming for 15 turnovers, ideally less, somewhere in that range, less than 18 certainly, and you'd feel pretty good. But there's some turnovers that are just going to occur naturally in the flow of the game, and some of them you're going to add just from unfamiliarity when you've got the guys on the floor that are not only on the floor with groups that maybe they haven't spent a lot of time with, but also being put into roles that they're also not familiar with. So overall, I thought the Lakers executed a great game plan, and I expect that we're going to see more of the same. And I, after game one, I'm more confident than ever that the Lakers have an edge on the coaching side of this. And so while I think that in game two, we may see the Rockets come out and throw some different things at the Lakers, some things that they didn't turn to in game one, I also believe that after halftime, the Lakers will make the necessary adjustments and will respond to what Houston is doing. Before we move into questions, comments, open this up. Anything else you guys want to add in before we just turn it over to the fans here?
Again, I just thought it was like an incredibly like fun to watch game. And like there was so little hope after what happened with Luka, and it felt so gloom and doom. And just shout out to JJ. Shout out to LeBron. Shout out to Marcus. Shout out to the guys in that. Even Ayton. Like, how about DeAndre Ayton bouncing back from like it looked like after the injury, him like everyone else just kind of went off the reservation, and DeAndre Ayton played one of the best games of his career in that playoff game. Like, I just admire the mental toughness of this group, and really ever since the All-Star break, this has become one of the more likable Laker teams that I've ever rooted for, and it's been a joy to cover them as closely as we've gotten to.
I'll say this. I don't think you guys are aware of this, but I flipped my series pick after game one, and I'm going Lakers in 7 now. So I think for me, the thing, and this kind of speaks to some of the offensive stuff and what Trevor was talking about with the turnovers, like, we just had not seen this group together against a good team post Luka and Austin injuries. The one game they played was OKC, but there was no LeBron in that game. And I think they were still kind of shell-shocked with everything that happened. But down the stretch, they played Dallas and Utah, who are both tanking teams, and half of Golden State and Phoenix's starting groups. So it just was not the best representation of what this group looked like against a really good team. I mean, I know KD was out and maybe the Rockets won the game with KD, but I felt like the Lakers to win this series needed to at least split the first two and extend it. They will now, I don't think they're going to sweep the Rockets. So I think there's going to be at least a game 5, if not a game 6. And that to me opens the door for Luka and or Austin to potentially return at the end of the series. But even then, like, I just think from a coaching and tactical perspective, again, I will reiterate my point. Chess versus checkers. And so I like, part of that prediction is partly an indictment of Houston and my lack of confidence in Houston as a team and the coaching staff and their adjustments. And I'm sure the Lakers will be plotting out the adjustments that they think Houston's going to make and being ready to counter those adjustments. But I mean, especially if KD misses another game, like any game he misses, and even if he returns, we have no guarantee he's not going to be physically compromised. To Jason's earlier point, like this is a patellar tendon thing now with his knee that just happened at the worst possible time. But I think that the premise of Houston being favored was that KD and LeBron could kind of wash each other out. And then Houston would have the advantage with a Şengün and a Thompson against like Marcus and Luke. But if KD's out or compromised, the Lakers clearly have the best player on the floor. And we saw, like, I don't think Amen or Alperin can impact the game to the same level that LeBron can. And it felt like LeBron still has way more left in the tank and could be even more aggressive as a scorer. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I still think it's going to be a long series, but I'm not above like changing my pick after seeing how a game played out and actually seeing what the Lakers offense looked like in a playoff context. I'm going Lakers in seven.
We talked about heading into the series that the Lakers had one player in the top five in the series. Unless somebody changed it, you needed guys to have above average performances in order to change that. Both Luke Kennard and DeAndre Ayton were definitely in the top five in that game in terms of players on the floor. And that changes the whole thing if you can get any kind of consistency out of them. And it doesn't even have to be them specifically. You just need a couple of guys to have above average games for the Lakers to next thing you know, flip it and have an advantage over the Rockets. All right, let's turn the rest of the show over to the chat. We're going to take your questions, your comments. First, a quick shout out to our sponsor, Shopify, and we'll be right back in 1 minute.
Starting something new isn't just hard. It's terrifying. There's always that moment before launching something where you're thinking, is this actually going to work? Whether it's starting a business, launching a product, or building something online, there are a lot of moving parts, and having the right tools behind the scenes can make a huge difference. That's where Shopify comes in. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. With hundreds of ready-to-use templates, Shopify helps you build a beautiful online store that matches your brand. It's also packed with helpful AI tools that can write product descriptions, page headlines, and even enhance your product photography. And Shopify helps you get the word out with email and social media campaigns so you can reach customers wherever they're scrolling. Plus, everything you need, inventory, payments, analytics, and more is all in one place. So it's time to turn those what ifs into cha-ching with Shopify today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/LakersPod. Again, that's shopify.com/LakersPod.
All right, let's get into some of our questions, our comments coming in. We had a few come in before the show started. This one from LeBronke said, I think Luke's form is absolutely sustainable because if you run him off the three, he has the handles to dish/get to the rim or hit the midi. That was one thing that I noticed is that even when Amen Thompson did try to fight over the screens, Kennard was just very willing to say, okay, cool, you fight over the top. I'm going to use this to get into the paint because now you're going to be topside on me. And then he wreaked havoc from there. I do think the Rockets are going to throw a lot more at Kennard. I don't think he's going to have the scoring game that we saw every single night in this series, but I am continue to be on a nightly basis really impressed with what Kennard is bringing. He's got a lot more to his offensive game in terms of the way he reads the floor than I would have suspected coming in. Jason, where are you at on Luke Kennard's performance? I know we haven't talked a ton about him yet in the show.
Well, I know everyone's seen the stat online, but I feel like it deserves a mention here that Gabe Vincent in 10 playoff games with the Lakers had 21 points total and Luke had 27 in one game. I will say I continue to struggle with some of like the victory lap stuff with Rob where I'm like, yeah, but he did sign Gabe Vincent. I think Luke, again, as you just very well laid out, Trevor, he's just a very gifted on-ball player. And I think the biggest thing that he's going to have to deal with in game two is the dynamic that happens in the NBA playoffs. Every year I've watched it since I started being an NBA fan, which is just after a team wins a playoff game, in that next game, there's always like this swing in force. We always want to talk about adjustments. Why? Because it's just easier to talk about. It's something that's more tangible. But the truth of the matter is like basketball games tend to swing back and forth on force, meaning like every single thing on the floor is a battle, whether it's like, okay, you're trying to contain the ball. I'm sliding my feet, but our shoulders bump. Do you blow through my shoulder or do I hold my ground? We're trying to fight for a rebound. Do I successfully box you out and secure the ball, or do you get past me somehow or beat me to the basketball? Like, even just little things like fighting through screens, setting good screens, competing for 50-50 balls, the transition battle up and down the floor. Everything really comes down to force in winning battles. And what tends to happen as you go from one game to the next is, yes, there are adjustments, but the biggest adjustment tends to be the team that lost the last game comes out playing a hell of a lot more physical and intense and hard than they did in the previous game. And then it becomes a question of mental toughness for the other team to be like, can you sustain the level of effort and execution that you had in the first game? And so that really is going to be the thing. Like, Amen Thompson's going to, he might mix in some unders, he might go over, it doesn't really matter. He's just going to do it harder than he did in game one. And it's going to be a question of whether or not Luke can continue to have success against improved intensity.
Agreed. Let me go to this one here. We've got Jeffrey said, any thoughts on the logo documentary? West was a young prodigy, but tortured himself with some brutal losses. I believe with a three-pointer, he would have averaged more than MJ's 30. Yeah, I don't know if I'll speak to whether or not he would have averaged more than the Michael Jordan. Certainly with the three, that changes the whole dynamic of the game and the era that he played in and all of that. But I'll just speak to the documentary itself. It was phenomenal. I don't know if you guys have watched it, but it was absolutely fantastic. It's on Amazon Prime. It is worth the watch. Does a tremendous job showing the man behind the player, you know, not just what he did on the floor, but the demons that he battled off the court, the frustrations as an athlete, as an executive, a lot of what made him tick, and extremely, extremely well done and well worth the watch. I don't know. Have you guys gotten a chance to see it?
I've not seen it yet, but it's on my list. Colin pointed it out to me last night.
It's definitely worthwhile. It is very, very good and highly recommended. All right, let's go to this one here. Mamadou said, man, Houston has no excuse. Yeah, no KD, but even without him, they still have a better team than the Lakers. Again, Houston was the favorite going into the game. Not by a lot, but they were the favorite. I think the difference is KD masks some of their issues, and those issues were very much exposed by the Lakers with Kevin Durant off the court. And some of it, they're not going to shoot as poorly again. The Lakers may not shoot as well again. But I do think this Houston team is very, very flawed, and I give a lot of the credit to the Lakers for exposing those flaws.
They were plus +7 net this year with Kevin Durant off the floor. They were still a good team without KD. But again, just ask Detroit Pistons fans. When you get to the postseason, it's no longer about what your regular season numbers are, what your record is. It's like, can you score against us and can we score against you? It's very matchup dependent. And like, this Lakers team just has such a strategic advantage. Like I said on my show, like if you were to list all the players by basketball IQ, you're listing LeBron 1 and Marcus 2, and then you're probably leaving like a dozen spots blank before you get to a Rockets player. Like, it's just, there's just a huge like experience and strategy advantage for the Lakers, which I think is proving to be problematic for them early on.
Let's go to this one. Rui is our most consistent. Jobin said, Rui's our most consistent. Need more than two rebounds, though. I'd go with Smith over Bronny. Jake has to look to score. Timmy would have been good in this series. Let's start with Rui is the most consistent. Jovan, your thoughts on that? Is that just true in terms of shooting? Because I see inconsistency defensively in the off-ball stuff.
Yeah, I would say from an offensive perspective, I mean, Rui's a steady mid-40s three-point shooter, around 50% on those middies. Someone asked me last night on my show if he's the new Sean Livingston. And then I was going through some of their numbers, and Rui obviously takes a lot more threes than Sean Livingston did. And Sean Livingston was basically half of his shots were those pull up middies and post up turnarounds and fadeaways, but pretty similar percentages. And it feels like Rui's mid range game has almost become Sean Livingston esque in terms of just every time he takes one of those pull up, you know, pump fake drive, pull up mid range jumper, you feel like it's going in. I would have a hard disagree on the defensive side. I actually think Rui's one of the least consistent defenders on the team and one of the guys who fluctuates the most. But again, like I said, he was good on my my initial take coming out of the game. Yesterday, I did a rewatch episode after I rewatched the game, took a bunch of notes. Like, I thought he was just awesome on the defensive game and defensive end. I thought he was better than even I thought in the moment. And just seeing the rim protection with a couple blocks and his help rotations, and he just was everywhere and like locked in to a degree that you like. JJ has the saying, like, you told on yourself, like, this is what I would like to see from Rui on a very consistent basis that we just don't. But I think Rui and DA were the two guys who, their motors can fluctuate, but they both were locked in. Attention to detail, focus was high. And now I think it's on both of them to sustain it. But I got to give Rui his flowers for how he performed. Do agree with the rebounding. Like, that's just one of his shortcomings and partly why I would not want to commit to him to being a starting power forward moving forward. I am open to Nick Smith Jr. over Bronny. I thought Bronny upon the rewatch wasn't as destructive as I thought he was live, but he had the one entry pass to LeBron on the wing where he throws it out of bounds, mm-hmm. and miscalculates where he thinks LeBron is going to be popping to, and then he had two fouls where he's just grabbing, and instead of, you know, arms wide being physical with his chest and footwork, he starts to grab the guy. So it wasn't like the best Bronny shift, and I understand why they didn't play him again in the second half and why they cut his minutes, but I think they need nine guys probably, even if it's only like 6 to 8 minutes. They need somebody, and I think it should be between Nick Smith or Maxi. Jake has to be more aggressive. I agree. I thought they did a good job of targeting Reed Sheppard, and then with Jake specifically, and just like his size and him getting downhill, and then some good things happening out of that, but he could shoot more. And then, yeah, I mean, I was pro signing Timmy, but they went in a different direction.
Jason, would you, after that first shift from Bronny, would you move away from him for game two and go to Nick Smith?
I agree with Jovan. I think other than the post entry, I didn't think he was like destructive necessarily. It was such a short shift. There were so few possessions. Like, the ball never even ended up in his hands off the ball offensively. Like, to be honest, I don't really have a take on the Bronny thing, in the sense that he was just out there for such a brief window of time. He had that one bucket he gave up to Amen Thompson, but he kind of like forced Amen into one of his toughest shots of the game, like that drifting floater going away from the basket. The one thing that was weird on that contest is like he contested with his right hand, like at the top of the shot, and I was like, just stick your left hand out there. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw him again, and I think it's too small of a sample to really. What he didn't do was positively impact the game, which I think is why you saw JJ shrink the rotation in the second half.
All right. Francis Laker said the Laravia with Vando lineups are kind of hard to watch. Also, when will the Rockets ask for Jovan to mimic Jake in their game plan for tomorrow? You get to be the decoy Jake Laravia there. Jovan, are you
Mom
free
over there after the show?
if you see Kevin Durant, maybe you can just, you know, accidentally bump into his knee another time and see how that goes. As far as the Laravia and Vando lineups, Jason, something that they just kind of out of necessity, they kind of have to continue to use just because they're short on players at this point?
Yeah, I'm actually checking the numbers right now real quick on Cleaning the Glass. They were plus 43 net in 10 possessions, so that's basically plus 4 points. They had a they performed well statistically in the very brief stretch that they were out there. But yeah, I think like in general, like you said, it's just, this is the reality, guys. Like, this is what we got. this is what we got. This is how we have to put the lineups together. There were definitely some stretches where I was watching the game with my wife and I'm like looking over at her and I'm like, there are three dudes on the floor right now that cannot make a three.
Yeah. But then I think again, to this point, this would be one of my adjustments where I think they did adjust it after the first non-LeBron shift. A little bit, but I think the non-LeBron minutes, they were minus two in the 10 non-LeBron minutes, which I actually think is a win for the Lakers, just being a minus two. It's a huge win. But the first shift, they went with Jake, Vando, and Jackson as the front court, and no Rui, no DA, and then Marcus and Luke as the back court. I like having Marcus and Luke out there because you're throwing all your ball handling that you trust out there when LeBron is out. But I think you need one of Rui or DA out there in that front court. You can't go Jake, Vando, Jackson. That you're just too limited from a shooting and just offensive skill perspective. So They did adjust that later on, where there was one shift they went Rui and DA, another shift they went with Rui, another shift they went with DA. So I think it's got to be like, I give kudos to the coaching staff for acknowledging that and realizing like, all right, we had it too like one-sided with the offense without LeBron. But I mean, like, that's the key thing is just, can they score when LeBron is off the floor? And to do that, I think you have to prop up those lineups with your best remaining offensive talent.
Agreed. Agreed 100%. This comment said, Jason, I gained some weight and lost my jumper. Help.
Reps. That's all you got to do. Every single kid that I've ever coached or talked to about the jump shot, it's all about reps. You just got to get in the gym and shoot as many times as you can over and over again. Limit unnecessary movement. Don't have a million moving parts, but ultimately trust your release and just get lots and lots of reps.
All right, we'll go here.
In the kitchen. It's not just the gym. It's about the kitchen when it comes to your weight.
Very true. You can't outwork a bad diet. I can tell you that for sure. Should we prioritize Rui, Luke, and Marcus over AR? If we're talking about in free agency, I'm assuming here. Each of them have an elite NBA skill. Austin Reeves doesn't. If we can get Braun and Wiggins, do we let AR walk? I mean, Jovan, everywhere I've broken down the cap situation, I don't see any way it benefits the Lakers to let Austin Reeves walk, especially with him being on a 20-ish million dollar cap hole. That to me doesn't seem like a good use of their resources here, nor does that open up significant flexibility if you were to let him walk. You're talking about a $20 million difference. I just don't see that as realistic, that they would prioritize those guys over AR if push came to shove and you had to choose between any one of those and Reeves.
I mean, I don't really know how to respond to this. I think this is taking the AR discourse too far. I mean, with some of these hypotheticals, we can have the theoretical discussion of what we think is best. And I obviously don't think they should prioritize either of those or any of those three guys or adding a Wiggins. I don't even think Wiggins is going to opt out. He's got a player option, and I think he's going to pick that up. So Wiggins will be under contract. He's not going to be a free agent. But I'm just telling you, the Lakers are not going to let Austin Reeves walk. Now, is there going to be some haggling over the final number? Sure, I think so. And I think it hurts his contract or case maybe to some degree that he wasn't available for the playoffs, so the Lakers couldn't get a better read on it. And look, we'll see. Maybe he is able to return this series, or the Lakers win the series, and then he's able to return against OKC in round two. But I'm just telling you, that's not going to happen. Austin is the priority, the biggest priority for LA this offseason. And it's like they're going to keep him. It's just a matter of what does that look like in terms of the final number. But there's no, I think the only way he would not be a Laker is if they ended up flipping him in some sort of trade for another superstar, not like Andrew Wiggins or something. Like if Giannis changes his I don't want a vacation in LA and says, hey, I want to go to LA, and Milwaukee's like, all right, we're only doing this if Austin's in the trade, I think they will consider that. If Cleveland loses in round two and Donovan Mitchell's available and it becomes, hey, we want Austin in this trade, I think they would consider that. They're not trading him for Wiggins, and they're not letting him walk for nothing.
Yep.
Can I share some stats real quick? Just because, yes, of this idea that Austin's not good at anything. There were 31 players in the NBA this year that ran at least 650 ball screens, including passes, and Austin ranked sixth in efficiency. Here's a list of players that Austin's ball screens were worth more points than: Jalen Brunson, Donovan Mitchell, Cade Cunningham, LaMelo Ball, James Harden, Derek White, Steph Castle, Jaylen Brown, Kevin Durant, Peyton Pritchard. Like, the dude, like, I understand that he had some issues with big games, and that's going to be the next step for him, but he just keeps getting better every single year. So I think we're foolish to bet that he can't continue to improve. And again, like, his elite NBA skill is that he's already, at this point, one of the most efficient large sample shot creators in the league.
Ultimately, I come back to this on all the Austin, and obviously we've had way too many Austin Reeves conversations over the last year and a half or so, year, I guess. But ultimately, I come back to this. Like, I think you can make arguments for why you should maybe move him, or is he the best fit next to Luka and all that. You can also make very strong arguments that, yes, he is a great fit next to Luka. There's a lot of things that you could point to this year. But I understand the counterpoint to it, right? That, okay, he struggles against these big athletic matchups. He struggles in certain situations. He's had, you know, a rough playoff series last year. I think all those things are credible, and we can look at them. But ultimately, and I come at this from the perspective of a Lakers fan, you've got a guy who had the opportunity to get drafted years ago, said, no, I want to be a Laker, grew up a Kobe fan, has said at every turn that he wants to play his entire career with the Lakers. He's the most successful guy that they've added to their team in years. We've talked about their struggles to draft players and find players and develop players. And we get people all the time that talk about, well, you know, LeBron, he's more of a mercenary. He's not really our guy, right? We didn't get the full, even though he's been a Laker for 8 years. That's not the same. It's different when a guy comes to a team when they're a rookie, and we got to see Kobe his entire career and how special that is and all of that, and we hold that against other players. You've got a guy who started his career with the Lakers, who turned down opportunities to go elsewhere, who's made it clear he wants to be a Laker and nothing but a Laker. I think with that scenario, you want to give that guy every opportunity to exhaust all possibility of him fitting. And again, there's arguments you can make both sides of that, but I think he needs to be given the leeway to continue to grow and continue to improve, rather than just be jettisoned at the first hint that, you know, he struggles against certain kinds of teams or whatever. It's interesting that people are just constantly trying to get rid of him when it seems like he's exactly the type of player in terms of his commitment to being a Laker that fans have been asking for years.
Tyler Herro is a $30 million player who has played in 50 playoff games and has scored 20 points 9 times. And Austin's done it 10 times in just 26 playoff games. And that's with him obviously having flaws that he's working through and like steadily improving, making like gigantic leaps year over year. Like, and we had this discussion on the show where I was talking about him being discounted, and then Jovan made the very important point that's like, just start listing the guards who make over 30 million. Austin's better than most of them. So like, it's just one of those things where I think people galaxy brain themselves in this situation where like Austin, even with all his flaws, is just really good. Look at how the Lakers fell apart this year over a large sample when he was out, and then immediately took off when he came back. Like, Austin is just, even with his flaws, yes, he's got an OKC problem. Yes, he's got things to work out, but that dude is good, and the team is better with him. And if we lost him, he'd make some other team better.
All right, we'll do one more, and then I'm going to save the rest of our chat questions here because we are running short on time. Kevin said, Cran just posted LA had a 77% organized offense rate. We talked about that a little bit earlier. The 2020 Lakers and 2024 Mavs had a 90% plus organized offense. Why does JJ run organized offense less during the regular season?
Because he had Luka Doncic.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But Krangis is right, and that was the story of the game. I thought, like, right away watching the game, I'm like, they are so structured right now.
No notes. Yeah.
All right, everybody, appreciate all the super chats. We did have a few that we didn't get to, but I will hang on to those and make sure that we address them next time, or I'll put them together in a show. Appreciate all of you. Please make sure you hit the subscribe button if you haven't done so yet. We will be back on Wednesday, right? After game two. Guys, this was awesome. And big picture, hey, Lakers are up 1-0. It's a good day.
It's good to see you guys. Let's see what happens tomorrow
night.
Great
to see you guys. Shout out to the chat.
Tomorrow night. Yeah, shout out to the chat.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much. See ya. And stay safe.